Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
Welcome to Holistic Survival number 10, where we are talking about protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Today we have a great interview with Lawrence Gonzalez. He is the author of Everyday Survival and also Deep Survival, and he talks about why smart people do stupid things in survival situations. I think you'll find this pretty interesting. Before we go to the interview, I just want to tell you that if you are interested in the profit side, remember, it's people, places, and profits. Listen to the Creating Wealth show and join us when Platinum Properties Investor Network presents the Creating Wealth Bootcamp on November 14th here in Orange County, California. We'd love to have you join us. For more information, go to jasonhartman.com and join us for that. Also, we've got a bunch of resources at the jasonhartman.com website and also at the holisticsurvival.com website as well. So make sure you check those out and take advantage of them. So people, places, and profits, let's listen into the interview with Lawrence Gonzalez. It's my pleasure to welcome Lawrence Gonzalez to the show today. He is coming to us from Illinois, and his latest book is Everyday Survival, Why Smart People Do Stupid Things. Lawrence, great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about your overall background, if you would, and then let's talk about a couple of your books.
Well, my background is as a journalist, and my specialty in journalism over time became studying people who did dangerous things. I did a lot of work doing some dangerous things myself and studying people who either did dangerous things or things that required extreme concentration, like brain surgeons, for example. And in the course of this, I became very interested in what made people survive and what failures people experienced in trying to survive. And out of that grew my book, Deep Survival, which came out in 2003, which is the subhead is Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why, which is what that book is about. And then I moved from individual survival to a larger question of our survival as a species and our survival in this world and what we're doing globally that may affect it. And everyday survival is much more about that than about the individual.
You list 12 rules for survival, I believe, on your website, and that's probably in one of the books, I assume, as well. Can you kind of give us a review of some of those 12 rules?
Yes. What I did was I studied hundreds and hundreds of cases where people had survived and what they had gone through in the course of surviving, and I tried to glean the things they had in common.
Mm-hmm.
And this was true whether it was somebody in a Nazi concentration camp or somebody adrift at sea or stuck on a mountaintop or whatever. And that's where these 12 rules of survival came from, which are in the book Deep Survival. And the first one is perceive and believe, which means don't engage in denial. One of the most natural traits when we get into trouble is to think, oh, it's not really happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that just wastes time and it prevents you from doing something useful. And I go into, I don't know if you want me to go through all of them or not, but stay calm is the second one because
sure.
as I describe in the book, reason and emotion work kind of like a seesaw. If emotion is high, you can't really reason clearly. And if you're reasoning clearly, it tends to dampen emotion. So keeping your emotions under control, not eliminating them, but keeping them under control helps you to think through things when you're in trouble. This is true whether you're talking about an emergency like falling off a boat in the middle of the ocean or, you know, getting cancer or going through a divorce, any kind of emergency that can raise emotions.
Lawrence, it's really interesting that when we use the word survival, of course, everybody sort of assigns a different connotation to that word. But when you address it, you really address just a huge, broad sort of concept of survival, everything from cancer to a divorce to maybe a bad business deal to falling off a boat in the middle of the ocean. That's a very broad view of survival.
Yes, it is. And to tell you the truth, the concept of survival, which has become very popular since Deep Survival came out, is a little bit of a trick. I mean, because what we're really talking about is decision making in most of these cases. Now, there are other elements to it that involved and tend to be involved without people realizing it. For example, your state of mind is extremely important. Your emotional state of mind and whether or not you feel good, for example, is a very important ingredient in succeeding in anything. And so having techniques to make yourself feel good, which sounds kind of like a flimsy concept, but it's not,
sure,
is a way to cause yourself to succeed, whether you're succeeding in business or you're succeeding in, you know, you've lost your job and you're trying to get another job. If you're depressed, you're gonna have a hard time of it. And so when I talk about survival, I'm talking about succeeding at making good decisions. So when I do my speaking engagements, for example, a lot of what I talk about is how we make bad decisions and how we can make better decisions.
Before you go into the, and I agree with you, it's all about making the right decisions, because probably the most important element in any survival scenario is how we think, and how we think, of course, determines how we act. Give us a couple of examples, because it's particularly interesting, you know, even you acknowledged that seems like a flimsy concept of making yourself feel good. What would be a couple of methods for making yourself feel good about a tough situation?
Well, in deep survival, I describe a case of a guy named Steve Callahan who was shipwrecked at sea, and he was adrift in a raft, a very small raft, I might add, for 76 days.
Wow.
Not a record, but it's a very long time. And he had nothing really, you know, he had a small survival kit, and he had very little to work with. And he was constantly being besieged by problems like leaks in the raft and sharks wanting to attack him and all of this different stuff, which he had to battle even while trying to keep from starving to death or, you know, running out of water. And so he had this method by which he, every time he succeeded at doing one little task, he would celebrate his success by doing something like allowing himself a drink of water or a piece of fish that he had caught. And what he was doing was he was renewing his store of energy, his store of sort of personal, spiritual, emotional energy, so that he could go to the next task. And we find in the best survivors, the best decision makers indeed, that what they do is they take big tasks and they break them down into small tasks. And when they succeed at the little tasks, they reward themselves in some way, and that gives them the strength to go on.
So celebrating small incremental steps and small victories.
Yes.
That's fantastic. Yeah,
and you see this a lot in the corporate world. People build in incentives so that when workers do a small task correctly, they get rewarded. Another element in this is how socially connected you are. People who are more socially connected tend to be better survivors. And one particular example that struck me was a fellow who was out in Grand Teton National Park cross-country skiing by himself in midwinter, and he broke his leg. And he was miles away from where he had parked. And he knew he had to get himself out on his own. And he could only get out by scooting along on his bottom, you know, using his arms. Very tedious, very tedious. It took him days and days and days. And I said, well, how did you do it? And he said he moved in sets of 100 moves. And every 100 moves he dedicated to something or someone in his life that he loved, that he wanted to get back to. So his wife, his music, you know, his sports, his family, whatever he could think of that he loved in life. And so this social connection sort of drew him along in his quest to get back.
That reminds me of really kind of the Viktor Frankl man's search for meaning type concepts, where the people that survived the Holocaust, they had a reason, whether the reason was positive, it was seeing someone you love again, or wanting to make a difference in the world, or it was even negative, you know, getting revenge against the guards.
Yeah.
It can work either way, can't it?
Well, yes, there's a famous case among search and rescue people that they refer to this fellow who was lost in the desert, and they went out to find him, assuming they would find a body. He'd been out there 6 days, I think, which is too long. You can't live that long without water. Well, they found him alive, and they said to him once he'd recovered, well, how did you do it? And he said, well, I was going through a very bad divorce, and I just didn't want her to get everything.
I love that.
That can be a motivator, too.
Right.
But some connection to the world will bring you back to the world.
Right, right. Yeah, very good point. Socially connected people have more of a reason, a raison d'être, you know, a reason to survive. Yeah.
In fact, there are scientific studies that show that people who are socially embedded in a social network tend to live longer anyway. Forget about being lost at sea. They tend to live longer and be healthier anyway.
Sure. Yeah. Okay, good. Tell us more.
Well, so, and you mentioned Viktor Frankl, some of the people that I studied and wrote about in Everyday Survival and Deep Survival were people in concentration camps. My father was in a Nazi prison camp, as a matter of fact. And one of the things that's surprising about them is how they find ways to appreciate what's beautiful in the world and to feel gratitude, even in the worst situations. Viktor Frankl talks about this where the prisoners would come out in the evening just to watch the sunset and remark how beautiful it was. In fact, there was a great deal of art produced in the prison camp in Auschwitz. There's a large collection of art from Auschwitz that has made a touring exhibition at times. And there's everything from beautiful pencil drawings to cartoons. There was one, I saw one, that was actually Mickey Mouse Goes to Auschwitz. It was a comic book that someone had produced in Auschwitz, one of the prisoners.
Wow, amazing.
And this was stuff that they had to conceal. If they were caught with it, they'd be killed. So all of this art was hidden. But it gives you an idea of how the human spirit survives in extreme situations. And it's no different if you're going through chemotherapy for cancer, or if you're going through a terrible business climate, or you lose your home, or whatever befalls you. These are things that can help you.
I would certainly agree with that. So you've got a couple more steps here. I know we've sort of haven't covered them specifically for the last few, but I think the last one was really number 8, see the beauty, right?
See the beauty.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good.
And I regard survival as a spiritual quest. One of the things that I've noticed about people who go through these things is that they come out of it, the best of them, the ones who survive most successfully, come out of it. Although you'd never wish this on yourself, they come out of it grateful for what the changes were that it brought about in their lives. I know one woman who was attacked by an 8-foot shark that basically tore her arm off, and she would have died except her husband happened to be a trauma surgeon, and he was right there on the boat when this happened and saved her life. And she was severely disabled by it, and now she's recovered completely. She has a mechanical hand, but she talks about how it enriched her life to go through this, how she never could have been the person she is without that. And part of that comes from this ability to see the beauty when you're in the middle of something terrible.
That is amazing to me. On a sort of linear plane, you think, a shark bit my arm off. I almost died. I'm grateful to be alive still. But how do you see the beauty in that? I mean, where's the beauty in a shark biting your arm off?
Well, you know, it's interesting what you notice when you're going through these things. Steve Callahan, the guy who was set adrift at sea when his boat sank and drifted for 76 days, he was covered with saltwater sores. He was being attacked at every turn by sharks. He was starving to death, emaciated, and everything was breaking that was supposed to be working. And he sat in the evening, in the nighttime, in his raft and looked up at the stars and just contemplated how beautiful it was. And he said he felt like he had a view of heaven from a seat in hell. And there was another woman I know who was in a plane crash on top of a mountain in the Sierra Nevada at about 12,000 feet, and she was in a cocktail dress. She was not dressed for being in the wilderness. She was going to a party and high heels. And she had to walk down this 12,000-foot mountain, climb down. She'd never done any climbing, had a broken arm, and was in terrible shape. And yet she said going through this beautiful landscape, she just allowed herself to be overtaken by how marvelously beautiful it was and how lucky she was to have this, have it all to herself. And that was her attitude. And you can call it a little crazy, but that attitude of joyous acceptance and appreciation of this sustained her for the 36 hours that she climbed down this mountain.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
So it's having that ability to give yourself something joyous.
Yeah.
That helps you get through.
To find the best in it. And you know, of course, as I'll go back to Viktor Frankl, but how we choose to perceive a situation is what he called the last human freedom.
Yes. And there was a woman that Viktor Frankl talked about who was dying, and she knew she was dying. And she had been some sort of society woman back in her original life before she was captured by the Nazis. And Viktor Frankl was talking to her in her last hours, and she said, you know, I'm really glad this happened to me because I was really brought down off of my perch. And I never was spiritually a very deep person, but now I am, and I never would have gotten here if this hadn't happened to me. So even in her dying moments, she was grateful for the experience and how she had grown in the experience. And I know another woman who had cancer, and she was going through chemotherapy and feeling sorry for herself and bemoaning her fate. And she went to the hospital to get her treatment and happened to see this ward of children who were getting chemotherapy. And these were these little 5, 7, 10-year-old kids who were going through chemotherapy, and they were bald. They'd lost their hair. And she said, all of a sudden she realized, wow, these little kids can do this. I can certainly do it. And she started devoting her time to going and being with the children and entertaining them. And it completely took her out of herself. And that's one of the points that I make over and over again about survival, is that people who are best at it do it for someone else or for some higher thing outside of themselves.
Yeah, certainly agree with that. You know, I'd like to ask you about number 10 specifically, which is surrender. And you may not have addressed this in your work or thought much about it, but I want to ask you about Stockholm Syndrome. little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe you want to talk about surrender first, but I'm kind of particularly interested in what happens as a survival mechanism with Stockholm Syndrome, because there are those who say it's really a survival technique.
Yeah, I think it is. Survival by surrender is not quite that.
Okay.
Survival by surrender refers to our tendency to hold on too tight to what we have can work against us in a survival situation. And what we mostly want to hold on to, of course, is our lives. And in an extreme situation, the best survivors will say to themselves, okay, what's the worst that can happen? Well, I might die. In fact, the situation I'm in, I probably will die. For example, you know, your plane crashes on top of a mountain or you're cast away at sea, your chances are pretty slim. And yet you say to yourself, okay, I've accepted that, but I'm still breathing in and out. What can I do next? So you sort of surrender to the idea that you may lose, and then you commit yourself to doing whatever you can do next to continue your survival journey. And so, and I see this happen all the time with cancer patients, because they'll be given a diagnosis and told, okay, you've got 6 months to live. Well, some people will say, oh, great, I've got 6 months to live, and they'll be dead in 6 months. Other people will say, well, I may be dead in 6 months, but I'm going to just do everything I can to make sure that I live a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go on and they live 6 years instead of 6 months.
Right.
And so, you know, we're all going to die at some point. We're all going to experience bad things in life, you know, whatever it is, the death of a loved one, illness, accident. And so the point of survival by surrender is not to focus on that bad outcome, but to accept that and let go of it, surrender to it, and then go ahead and do the next thing you can do.
So there's got to be kind of a balance, though, in this surrender concept, because what I would say, being a little bit of a devil's advocate or a skeptic here, is that the surrender attitude could lead more to like, hey, I've only got 6 months to live. Let's just live it up. Frankl recounts in the concentration camps, the people that he knew were going to die had surrendered, in essence, would trade their food for a cigarette. So where's the balance in that? I mean, you mentioned to it, okay, accept your fate, but then decide you're going to do everything you can do to survive. But some would say, just be more hedonistic and eat all your food rations today and drink all your water today. And
yeah, no, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
And the key word here is balance, because it is balance. You have to be an activist in your surrender.
Mm-hmm.
You have to really want to do the next thing. And this is where what we talked about, being socially connected and so forth. You know, you have to really want to get back to something in your life. And Frankl talks about this too. So even while you're, the part that surrender plays is in, it unburdens you of having to focus on the bad outcome. So it relieves you of the burden. You say, okay, well, that's out of my hands. If a shark comes and eats me, you know, well, there you are. It's over. But until that happens, I have a plan, and here's my plan, and I'm going to do it step by step. And so it's a slightly different approach from simply throwing up your hands. It's a way of lessening your burden while you do your job. So it's a little bit different approach.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good distinction, because when you stop focusing on it's the end, it really relieves you of a lot of sort of psychological baggage so you can take action, right?
Yes. Well, in Deep Survival, there's another shipwreck case where there's five people on a raft, and two of them are guys who are not very good survivors. And they're both screaming, we're all going to die, we're all going to die, we're all going to die, right? And you know, they're the ones who are going to die, because that's what they're focusing on.
Right.
And in fact, they do die. And so the surrender of that part takes you out of the we're all going to die mode and puts you into the what can I do next mode.
Yeah, good distinction. What about Stockholm Syndrome? Do you study that or address that at all?
You know, I haven't addressed that specifically. In fact, I don't think that I wrote about a kidnapping. But in fact, it does make a kind of sense, because you can't operate under constant stress all the time. And there's also a natural human tendency to connect with people.
Let's kind of just, before we go into it too much, let's kind of give our listeners, just in case there's someone out there that doesn't know what it is. It's when in hostage cases, people are taken hostage after a certain time period. Many of them kind of identify with their captors and become sympathetic to their cause, which you would think is very odd. You're being victimized by somebody, yet you would have sympathy for them. It's sort of an odd thing. And what I heard about it recently is that that is a survival mechanism, because if you don't become sympathetic to their cause, then, you know, maybe they're more likely to kill you. That was sort of one take on it that I recently heard. But I hadn't thought
Yes, I could understand that, but I don't think it's quite that planned out. I think people who experience that are doing a couple of very natural things. Humans are social animals,
right,
and they will socialize with whatever is available. And there are many survival stories, that some of which I tell in my books, where somebody's lost in the wilderness completely alone, and they start talking to the animals. people have seen the Tom Hanks movie Castaway.
Sure.
He starts talking to his basketball or soccer ball or whatever.
Yeah, Wilson.
Wilson, friend. You know, that's a classic survivor technique.
Okay.
And it's perfectly normal and it's pretty common. And so if there's a person there, you're much more apt to engage with the person, even if the person is your captor.
Right.
And so I think it's a very natural thing, and it's something that, people may come away feeling guilty about, but I don't think there's really a need to.
And then your final step is, of course, never give up, which
right.
makes perfect sense. Tell us more about the deep survival and everyday survival techniques and ideas and rules and maybe cases. I mean, those cases are so interesting. You sort of surveyed a lot of people that had been through these situations and heard what they had to say after the fact, huh?
One of the things that I talk about in everyday survival is how, you know, we have the impression that if we open our eyes and look around us, we see everything that's in the world, but that's not how perception works. We actually make mental models of things, and we store those mental models. And when we see something that looks vaguely like it, we don't really see the thing itself. We see the mental model. So, for example, if you look at a sign for handicapped parking, you immediately see a person in a wheelchair. If you look at it closely, it doesn't really look like a wheelchair or a person. It's just a bunch of lines. But the reason we recognize it is because of this mechanism in the brain that makes mental models. So I tell this story on myself when I give talks. I was hiking in the Santa Monica Mountains above Los Angeles one time, and I came across the ruin of an old house, old stone collapsed house, and there was just the chimney standing up and a bunch of rubble. And I thought, oh, this is great. Maybe I'll find some souvenir to take home and show the kids, like an old tool or something. So I started poking around in this rock ruin. Well, when I was a little kid, my grandmother had an ashtray that was a ceramic rattlesnake with its head sticking up, and it was this dark, dusty color, and I really thought that was a cool thing. And as I'm poking around in this rocky ruin, I look down, and there's my grandmother's ashtray lying on the ground, and I reached out to pick it up, thinking, wow, this is amazing. Same kind of ashtray, and its tongue came out.
It was a real snake.
I realized I was about to pick up a real rattlesnake.
Wow.
Sitting right there in front of me.
Amazing.
Because all these years I had stored this mental model in my head, and it had these nice associations with my grandmother, and that was what was stuck in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I had no competing mental model for the dangers of rattlesnake because I had no experience with rattlesnakes. And so this thing took over my actions involuntarily at that moment. Without my thinking logically, I could have told you, hey, you're in the high desert mountains where rattlesnakes are common. You're in a rock ruin where they like to go and hunt for mice. You know, what are the chances of ever finding your grandmother's ashtray?
Right.
Which are about zero. You know, so I knew all these things intellectually, but they didn't help me at that moment when I needed them. So we play out these scenarios all the time, and we do them in very complex behaviors. In everyday survival, I call them behavioral scripts, where we do the same thing enough times and it becomes unconscious, like tying your shoe. You don't have to think about it. And the system is very powerful if you think about it. If you try to teach a 4-year-old to tie a shoe, it's very hard to teach him. But once he learns, he never has to think about it again. So it takes something that requires all of your attention and turns it into something that requires none of your attention, which is quite a feat. And people make terrible mistakes by following these behavioral scripts without thinking. Often we drive without thinking, for example.
Sure. Sort of the alpha state we get into where we just sort of do things by rote and don't
right.
even notice them anymore.
There's a famous rock climber named Lynn Hill, a holder of 30 international titles, and she was going to climb a warm-up climb one day in France, and she was tying her rope to her harness to make this little easy climb, and someone interrupted her while she was doing that, and she turned and had this conversation, and then she bent down and tied her shoes, went ahead and climbed, and when she got ready to rappel, she leaned back and fell 72 feet because she had forgotten to tie the rope to her harness.
Oh my gosh.
So, and she lived, by the way, but
wow,
barely, you know, she fell into a tree. She otherwise would have been killed.
Right.
And this is the top climber, you know, this is somebody who more training could not have helped her. She is as trained as you can get.
Sure.
And what happened was she had this behavioral script for tying a shoe and for tying a knot in her harness that were very close together. So once she tied her shoe, her brain said, okay, you're all done. You can climb now. All unconsciously, of course. And this is the way we can get ourselves into real trouble through these mechanisms.
And so the way to overcome that is to, when you're in a situation, to be careful of rote thinking, these scripts, and really think consciously rather than letting the unconscious semi-conscious thinking take over, right?
Yeah, it's called pay attention.
Yeah, okay.
Which we live in a culture that encourages us not to pay attention. You know, everything's done for us, everything's automatic, and we're always told, basically we're told by our culture that we're stupid. I mean, if you look at warning labels on things, it's
incredible.
One of my hobbies,
yeah.
Collecting warning labels. So I bought a printer for printing photographs, you know. You have these nice printers nowadays. So I bought an Epson printer, and I always read the manual, not because I want to know how it works, but because I want to see the warning label.
A guy guy who actually reads the manual, okay? What the warnings and labels say, don't swallow the ink.
It says don't drink the ink.
Right? Are you serious?
Don't drink the ink. Yes, absent. Look it up.
Amazing.
And I'm thinking, so, you know, the warnings become ridiculous when we start ignoring them. And basically sure. We just take the attitude that, well, I can't possibly know how my world works, so I'll just give up. And that's part of what I was trying to do in Everyday Survival, was to get people not to give up. You really can understand your world. This is an effort to understand it in a new way that will change your thinking.
You know what I'd like to do in kind of to wrap up here? We've got a few more minutes. The economy is in such peril right now. I'd like to talk a little bit about survival and or deep survival, as you put it, and business. And you've got some steps that you've outlined, and some of them are sort of obvious, but some, I'm not sure what you mean when you talk about bending the map and seeing the gorilla and celebrate, you know, avoid the Mount Hood syndrome, etc. Kind of go through some of those with us, because I think most people listening are really concerned about financial issues right now. And listeners to the show are concerned about what those financial issues may lead to in terms of civil unrest. Who knows what they will lead to? You know, the day-to-day now for most people is really just financial concerns,
yes.
Business concerns.
And I wind up talking a lot about that these days. But the principles are the same. When I refer to bending the map, I'm referring to a phenomenon where it's a sport called orienteering, where you have a very detailed map and you follow a route, and it's a sport, a game. And you come to a certain place, and on the map there's, you know, a lake. And you look in front of you and you say, well, you know, where is that lake? Maybe it dried up, you know, maybe the lake disappeared. I'm really in the right spot, but the map is just showing something that's no longer there. That's called bending the map. You know, if there's a lake on the map and you don't see the lake in front of you, that means you're in the wrong place. That really does mean that. And so there's a tendency, and I said, you know, this is, of course, what happened in this mortgage crisis that triggered the financial collapse. People were looking at a situation where a bank was saying to them, yeah, we'll give you this house for free and you really don't have to pay for it. And, you know, your map of everything you've learned over your lifetime tells you, well, that can't happen. You know, that's just a fantasy. That mm-hmm. can never work.
Yeah.
And yet people went for these mortgages and bought them, and sure enough, lost their houses. But that's a form of bending the map. Or the Madoff scandal. Bernie Madoff told all these people, I will give you 12, you know, I'll earn you 12%, 15% every quarter, no matter what happens in the market or the economy. Well, that simply never happens. And anybody who's ever bought a stock knows that. Some things go up, some things go down. And nobody makes 12 to 15%, especially these days.
So what you're saying is that they believe something that they shouldn't be believing just because kind of they want to? Is this like the sort of get-rich-quick scheme syndrome?
Yes, and it's also human nature to accept the most positive evidence.
Mm. Okay.
You know, there's a psychological fallacy called the confirmation bias, which means you'll take any evidence as supporting your own view. So if
right.
your view is, I'm not really lost, then you'll come up with anything you can come up with to support that, even if it's ridiculous, like somebody moved that boulder. And so we have to be aware of these kinds of biases when we look at the world around us to avoid trouble. Celebrating the summit is another one of the things I talk about. Typical mountaineering experience is you work very hard to get up the mountain. You know, you get up in the middle of the night so you can reach the summit in time. You finally get to the summit and, wow, it's really beautiful. You take photographs, you slap each other on the back and have something to eat and drink, and that's the end of the trip, right? That's the high point. Well, you're only halfway home at that point. You're in big trouble because you just finished your trip, and yet how do you get down? Well, most accidents happen on the descent because of that, because people tell themselves it's over, they've done it, they've succeeded, and then they become clumsy on the way down, they're tired on the way down. And in their mind, they're saying, well, I finished this, you know, why is this such hard work?
You know, that reminds me of the Napoleon quote, the most dangerous moment comes with victory.
Yeah.
Because people become complacent, so don't be complacent is really what you're saying there, yeah. What's the Mount Hood syndrome?
The Mount Hood syndrome, well, in Deep Survival, I talk about a big accident that happened on Mount Hood where nine climbers fell. And it basically all started with one guy at the top. He was roped to several other guys. And when he slipped, he pulled his whole team off because they were roped together. And they accelerated down the mountain, collided with another roped team, pulled them off. And they accelerated down the mountain and collided with another team and pulled them off.
Wow.
So it took three teams in sequence and killed, I believe, two people. I can't remember the number, but several were badly injured and a couple were killed, and resulted in this gigantic rescue effort in which a helicopter crashed. So this gigantic mess started with the slip of a foot that was like, you know, 6, 8, 12 inches of a foot slipping right at the top. Well, part of the point of that chapter in Deep Survival is that we engage ourselves with these very complex systems that we don't understand, in which little tiny influences can wind up having huge consequences. And the economy is one of those systems. When you engage yourself with a gigantic financial machine that you don't really understand, you're putting yourself in the middle of this, and little things can have huge results. And that's where we are right now.
In a highly interconnected world, that definitely happens. So it sounds like the advice there in avoiding the Mount Hood syndrome is be independent as much as reasonably possible.
If those guys had not been roped together, all of them would not have fallen.
Yes, right.
That's correct. But it's also to be cognizant of the fact when you engage yourself in one of these complex, tightly coupled systems, to know it. To know that you're doing that.
To realize that it's happening, sure.
Yeah, and to say, well, what safeguards am I putting in place if this whole thing goes, you know, down the mountain? And when you think about money, it's very much a system like that. All markets experience busts and booms. So you've got to look at them that way. We know this economy is going to come back and it's going to be good again. When it does that, people are going to start behaving just the same way they did before. And the smart people will say, what am I putting in place for the next collapse? Because there will be another collapse.
Yeah, good points. Lastly, the Zen concept of the beginner's mind in business and with money, what is that all about?
Well, the more experienced you get, in a sense, the more dangerous you become to yourself. Because there's a tendency to say, I really already know what's happening here. In fact, the system of perception that I was talking about with the mental models and the behavioral scripts is designed this way. I don't mean designed. I mean it evolved this way. It is set up so that as quickly as possible, you come to the conclusion that you know what's happening and you respond accordingly. So hence, I reach for the rattlesnake, right? I think I know what's happening, but I'm wrong. So if you get experienced, you tend to do this more and more and more. If you are able to put that experience aside and tell yourself that you really don't know what's happening, then you look more carefully before you act. And the beginner looks more carefully. So, for example, there are fewer accidents with student pilots than with pilots after they become students, you know, when they actually are out there, you know, accomplished pilots.
Because they're more careful
when
they have
afraid.
The beginner's mind. They're afraid, yeah, right.
Yeah, they're more cautious. And so being this way in our business and in our lives is a good thing to question, well, how much do I really know about this situation? Maybe I can get a little more information and make a better decision.
Yeah, very good point.
You can't fill up something that's already full is what the Zen people say. You know, if the cup is full, you can't add anything to it. So if you think you know everything, you're not going to learn anything.
Yeah, I remember hearing that story about the Zen instructor who was pouring the cup of tea and kept pouring it and pouring it, and the cup was overflowing, and the student said, you know, stop, and this is like your mind. You need to empty the cup so you can receive new knowledge, right?
Right. Yeah. Beginner's mind.
Yeah, the beginner's mind. That's very good. Well, Lawrence, what would you like to say in conclusion, and would you like people to know and tell us, give us your website and so forth too?
The website, the easiest one to remember is deepsurvival.com, and there's also lawrencegonzalez.com. But if you Google either one, you'll find it immediately. And as I mentioned, I think before we started, I have a new novel coming out from Knopf in the spring of 2010, and so that's very exciting. And I've just been very gratified to see the response I've gotten to these books.
Yeah, excellent. So most of your books are nonfiction, and you're doing a novel. I know you haven't done one in quite a while, you said, and that's coming out next year. What's the title of the novel?
The title is Lucy, from Alfred A. Knopf.
Okay. And
it's
do you
on
want
the website too.
Give a brief description of that?
Lucy is the story of a person who is a hybrid between a human and an ape, and it's shaping up to be a very explosive, controversial book, as well as an exciting read.
Fascinating stuff. Well, Lawrence Gonzalez, thanks for joining us today. The website is deepsurvival.com, and we appreciate your insights into survival of all types and how we need to use our mind and our psychology in these tough situations. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you for joining us today for the Holistic Survival Show, protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Be sure to listen to our Creating Wealth Show, which focuses on exploiting the financial and wealth creation opportunities in today's economy. Learn more at www.jasonhartman.com or search Jason Hartman on iTunes. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, offering very general guidelines and information. Opinions of guests are their own, and none of the content should be considered individual advice. If you require personalized advice, please consult an appropriate professional. Information deemed reliable, but not guaranteed.